led by Professor Alan Buell of the University of Toronto. It is a great honor to introduce Professor Robert N. Essick, Distinguished Professor of English Emeritus, University of California at Riverside. He has authored, co-authored, or edited 19 books and over 150 articles, notes, and reports on Blake and his circle. He's been an avid collector of Blake and all manner of Blakeiana for over 40 years. Please welcome Robert North Essick.
John Keats's Poems of 1817 is a rare and valuable book. What would be the scholarly consequences if 8 copies were destroyed? A major loss for their owners, but little impact on our access to and understanding of Keats's poetry. What would be the scholarly consequences if 8 copies of William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell were consumed by flames? We would have only one complete copy left. We would lose Blake's own variants in inking, printing, and coloring, found in 9 complete copies from 5 printing sessions over the course of 37 years. What if just one copy, see if this works. What if just one copy of Blake's first illuminated book, All Religions Are One, was washed away in a flood? We would have none. My bibliographically apocalyptic tale indicates the importance of preserving each original copy of Blake's writings. Like an artist's drawings and paintings, each copy of Blake's etched writings bears a more important relationship to his canon than what we generally find with an author's work. The material features of Blake's works and the means of production they record are part of their meaning. The vast majority of authors have nothing approaching Blake's role in the evolution of graphic and printing technologies. These special characteristics of Blake's productions in several media place particular responsibilities on their owners, both private and institutional. Thus, the history of Blake collecting and its relationship to scholarship plays a particularly important function in the study of the editing, reception, and interpretation of his contributions to the visual and literary arts. Blake's first great collectors were his 2 major lifetime patrons, Thomas Butts and John Linnell. Without Butts' patronage, we would not have over 200 of Blake's biblical watercolors. I'm going to be showing you a great many slides and saying virtually nothing about them, just to give you a sense of the treasures owned by these various collectors over many years. And tempera paintings. At least 4 sets of watercolor illustrations to John Milton's poetry. And the first series of illustrations to the Book of Job, and the finest group of the large color prints specially prepared for Butts in about 1805. Butts also acquired some of Blake's writings, including copies of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and I am showing you the copies that each collector actually owned, and Songs of Innocence and of Experience. There is no documentary evidence about the nature of Butts' interest in Blake, although Mary Lynn may be turning up something as I'm speaking. I suspect that, like many later collectors, Butts was more attracted to the visual than the literary component of the illuminated books. It is also possible that Butts had a special interest in the Bible and its illustration. Linnell's patronage had a somewhat different character. A fine artist himself, Linnell enlisted Blake shortly after their first meeting in 1818 as a partner in engraving projects. A few years later, Linnell commissioned the 2 masterpieces of Blake's final years, the Job engravings and the illustrations to Dante's Divine Comedy. The watercolor and then the engraving. Linnell's financial arrangements for these endeavors were a mixture of business acumen, patronage, and charity. Linnell was probably also instrumental in gaining for Blake the commission to illustrate Virgil's Pastorals in 1821. a project that resulted in Blake's only wood engravings. These are now considered to be among the finest British works in the medium and a major influence on several generations of artists from Edward Calvert to Graham Sutherland. Linnell also acquired many of Blake's writings, including Jerusalem, and the manuscript of Blake's longest poem, The Four Zoas. The Linnell collection remained in the family's possession until its dispersal at auction in 1918, a sale that laid the foundation for several Blake 20th century collections. Although neither a patron nor a collector except by bequest, Frederick Tatham played a leading role in the preservation, dispersal, and, alas, the destruction of Blake's works. At his death in 1827, Blake's remaining stock was inherited by his wife, Catherine. All but a few items passed at her death in 1831 to Tatham. The remaining group included a great many sketches and watercolors, books owned and annotated by Blake, the now lost copper plates of the illuminated books, and masterpieces such as the only complete colored copy of Blake's illuminated epic, Jerusalem. Tatham soon fell under the influence of the preacher Edward Irving, and apparently based on Irvingite doctrines, destroyed an unknown number of Blake's manuscripts and notebooks, believing them to be unclean, as he said, or inspired by Satan. But many works remained intact. He might have been right about the second. But many works remained intact, including the Jerusalem, and Tatham slowly sold them privately and at auction in 1862, a sale that included over 70 drawings by Blake. A few late 18th century collectors and numerous collectors through the 19th century acquired important works by Blake. Most of these early collectors, indeed most collectors to the present day, came to Blake because of an interest in books rather than drawings and paintings. Copies of his illuminated books were generally the featured treasures. It was not until 2004 when the large color print of the good and evil angels struggling for possession of a child brought $3.9 million at auction. One of Blake's purely pictorial works set a record which exceeded prices for the illuminated books for the first time. Several factors have inhibited the reception of Blake's pictures among major art collectors, including the fading of his watercolors from overexposure to light, the sad condition, and in some cases clumsy restoration of his tempera paintings of 1799-1800, this is a particularly sad example, and the opinion of many art historians that Blake couldn't draw or paint, as I've heard more than one scholar pronounce ex cathedra. The outstanding exception to the emphasis on the illuminated books was the Blake collection formed in the late 19th century and well into the 20th by W. Graham Robertson. His collection included 140 drawings, paintings, and color prints, by far the most representative selection of Blake's pictorial art assembled by an individual collector since Butts's patronage. The collection began heroically on 30 June 1886 with the acquisition of 40 drawings, all once in Tatham's possession. Between 1904 and 1907, Robertson complemented this initial group with some of Blake's finest watercolors and temperas from the Butts collection. Two of Blake's large color prints were acquired in 1905. Seven more joined the collection in one fell swoop in April 1906. The auction of Robertson's collection in 1949 created a controversy, particularly amongst dealers hoping for easy pickings. The executors of Robertson's estate placed high reserves on the more important works with the intention of distributing any unsold lots to British museums through the National Art Collections Fund. It appeared to potential bidders that the vendor was also a competitor and that the auction had been rigged. But there was no illegality, and several institutions benefited greatly. London's Tate Gallery received 21 works, including all the large color prints. Just to show you one more of these masterpieces. While in Robertson's personal possession, his collection of Blake's works was seen by only a select few, but simply by preserving, and in some cases restoring, these many treasures, Robertson provided an inestimable service to Blake scholars and eventually to the general public. Without Robertson's enthusiasm as a collector, Blake's studies in our own time would suffer from a dearth of original materials. North America's first and greatest Blake collector was William Augustus White of Brooklyn. White collected Renaissance emblem books. He may have been attracted to Blake's illuminated books because of their emblem-like pictorial iconography. Between 1890 and 1908, White acquired 19 copies of 14 illuminated books. But White did not limit the collection to Blake's books. He acquired Blake's notebook in 1887, and in 1908 added Blake's 537 watercolors illustrating Edward Young's Night Thoughts to create the largest Blake collection ever assembled by a private owner. After White's death in 1927, his heirs apparently enlisted the book auctioneer Arthur Swan and America's greatest book dealer, A.S.W. Rosenbach, always called Dr. Rosenbach by lesser mortals, to evaluate and sort out the collection. Their records are terse and somewhat confusing, but they indicate that many of the illuminated books were desired by members of the White family. Perhaps after a few missteps, most of the Blakes went to White's daughter, Mrs. Frances White Emerson. She later repatriated the Night Thoughts watercolors and Blake's notebook, giving the former to the British Museum and bequeathing the latter to the British Library. Two famous American book collectors active in the early 20th century deserve mention, even though neither was centrally interested in Blake. Both men founded institutions to maintain their collections and make them available to scholars and through exhibitions to the public. J. Pierpont Morgan began to collect Blake's works when he purchased two copies of Songs of Innocence and of Experience and one of Jerusalem from a London dealer in 1899. Three more illuminated books were added in the first decade of the next century. After its founder's death in 1913, the Morgan Library continued to make substantial additions to its Blake holdings, including 12 splendid watercolors illustrating Blake's L'Allegro, and if we can get to it, Il Penseroso. The collection of illuminated books more than doubled in 1973 when Mrs. Landon K. Thorne bequeathed 11 to the Morgan. The Morgan Library continues to be one of the more active institutional collectors of Blake's works. Unusually, it has also been a seller. With the addition of 13 plates from There Is No Natural Religion from the Thorne collection, it appeared to the Morgan staff that they had at least six duplicates. There is no such thing as a duplicate impression from one of Blake's relief etched plates, but nonetheless, the Morgan sold six prints at auction in 1977. Some years later, Joe Viscomi demonstrated that the supposed duplicates retained by the library are early facsimiles. Big mistake. But the ones sold are original prints by Blake. Henry E. Huntington made headlines with his many successful bids at the 1911 Robert Ho auction. Among these were three of Blake's illuminated books, including Milton, A Poem, and a copy of J.C. Lavater's Aphorisms on Man, extensively annotated by Blake. The Linnell auction of 1918 offered equally tempting opportunities for Huntington, among them the unique copies of All Religions Are One, Blake's first illuminated book, and The French Revolution, a letterpress work. Huntington was famous for buying whole collections, a strategy that resulted in boxes full of inconsequential volumes, but also great treasures. His copy of Songs of Innocence and of Experience came in 1912 as part of the Beverly Chew collection. The Song of Los, splendidly color printed by Blake and one of only six known copies, came with the Frederick R. Halsey collection in 1915. Huntington also acquired some of Blake's finest watercolors inspired by Milton's poetry, including series illustrating Paradise Lost, Comus, and On the Morning of Christ's Nativity. When combined with his copy of Milton, A Poem, Huntington's collection had become, within less than 6 years, the world's most important repository of Blake's direct responses to the writer who more than any other influenced his endeavors as both poet and artist. America's most formidable Blake collector in the first half of the 20th century was Lessing J. Rosenwald of Philadelphia. There he is in his study room. He began in about 1925 to collect old master and contemporary engravings and illustrated books. It was almost inevitable that he would become interested in Blake's etched illuminated books and other graphic productions. In 1929, Rosenwald acquired from Rosenbach an outstanding group of Blake's works, formerly in the White Collection, including 10 illuminated books for the then princely sum of $115,000. That's for all 10. Rosenwald's other major purchases of Blake's works followed apace whenever the market presented opportunities. The remainder of the Linnell collection, including the progress proofs of the Job engravings and the copper plates of the Dante engravings, were acquired in 1937. The British collector W.E. Moss, like Rosenwald, had a particular interest in Blake's printmaking techniques. At the Moss auction in 1937, Rosenwald acquired 10 lots, including copies of Songs of Innocence and Songs of Innocence and of Experience. The New York collector George C. Smith had assembled a first-rate collection of Blake's illuminated books in a remarkably short time. When these were sold at auction in 1938, Rosenwald was a successful bidder on 18 lots, including the Book of Thel. The legendary 1941 auction of the collection formed by the bibliophile and raconteur A. Edward Newton gave Rosenwald the opportunity to acquire one of Blake's most powerful essays in the apocalyptic sublime, the watercolor of the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun, and two illuminated books, Frontispiece to Europe. Unfortunately, one of the latter, There Is No Natural Religion, proved to be yet another copy of the early facsimile. Even the most astute collector can make mistakes. Rosenwald gave his collection, including some 22,000 prints by 250 artists, to the people of the United States in 1943. The Rosenwald Blake collection, divided at his death in 1979 between the Library of Congress and the National Gallery of Art, is rivaled only by the British museums. Rosenwald joined knowledge, connoisseurship, considerable wealth, and the hunting instincts of the born collector. There was a hint of sadness in his voice when, in the early 1970s, he told me that he could find nothing more to buy. He visited his gallery almost every day, eager to welcome scholars. I was surprised to find, on first visiting Alverthorpe, several ashtrays placed strategically about the gallery. These were for the exclusive use of Mr. Rosenwald. One day in the summer of 1973, while measuring some of Blake's commercial book illustrations in the collection, I felt a large but gentle hand on my shoulder. It was Mr. Rosenwald, leaning over the prints with a shockingly long ash dangling from his cigarette. I put my hand out, palm up, fearing an accident. He told me not to worry, that I had come a long way to study such mundane engravings, and walked away, I trust to visit one of the ashtrays, and returned with his copy of the Book of Urizen. Have a look at this, something a little better from Blake, he said. While Rosenwald's collecting activities were winding down, Paul Mellon's were beginning. Unlike most of his Blake collecting predecessors and contemporaries, Mellon was principally interested in British art rather than books, but his strong pictorial instincts led him to illustrated books and hence to Blake. The collection began in 1941 with a copy of There Is No Natural Religion, a genuine one this time, followed later in that decade by copies of Songs of Innocence and of Experience, the Book of Thel, Europe, and the magnificent hand-colored copy of Jerusalem. Mellon bought judiciously at the Emerson sale in 1958, acquiring Songs of Innocence and America. These and many other treasures are now at the institution he founded, the Yale Center for British Art. Although Mellon lived until 1999, I never had the opportunity to meet him and thank him for his generosity. In November 1971, Christie's brought to auction two of Blake's 9 extant wash drawings for Tyrael. His only finished drawings illustrated one of his own poems. I asked the London dealer John Baskett to bid on my behalf on the first Terrio lot, and if outbid, try for the second. At the time, I did not know that Baskett was a close associate of Mellon's and had received similar instructions from him. After Baskett told him about the potential conflict, Mellon proposed that we divide and conquer. He would not bid against me on the second drawing if I did not bid against him on the first. This was a lion offering a mouse to share the feast. He could have easily outbid me on both drawings. I leapt at the opportunity, and we both gained our prizes. I had to pay over the high estimate, but I should record this acquisition as gift of Paul Mellon. A survey of Blake collecting raises questions about its relationship to scholarship. The ideal is, of course, mutual interchange, and that has generally been the pattern in Blake studies. Several collectors, including W.E. Moss and Graham Robertson, pursued their own researches into Blake's printing methods. But it is two remarkable scholar collectors, Sir Geoffrey Keynes and Professor G.E. Bentley Jr., who best exemplify a symbiotic relationship between these two pursuits. Early in this century, Keynes, he is the white-haired gentleman and some anonymous acolyte over there, began to collect Blake comprehensively, not just the few major works he could afford, but a host of Blake's commercial book engravings, individual pages from the illuminated books, and separate plates, often costing shillings rather than pounds. While American millionaires were gathering up the masterpieces, Keynes would pick up neglected scraps and sketches that helped him assemble a complete picture of Blake's activities as poet and artist. It took a Mellon to acquire the complete colored copy of Jerusalem. Keynes could only afford a rather odd-looking frontispiece to the book with a plate from Blake's Europe printed on the verso. This, however, was an unrecorded proof, the only impression that includes all the inscriptions above and on the doorway through which Blake and his readers enter into the depths of the epic poem that follows. Keynes's collection provided part of the material base for his publication of the first comprehensive Blake bibliography and the first complete scholarly edition of his writings. Visiting Lammas House, Sir Geoffrey's home in the Suffolk village of Brinkley, was a magical experience, like stepping back to an earlier era. Blake's works filled the walls and bookcases in several rooms. The large color print of Naomi entreating Ruth and Orpah hung over the mantel in the front drawing room, with two of the Tyrael drawings almost hidden in a recess next to the fireplace. From my customary seat at the dining table, I could turn to the right and view Blake's large drawing of Laocoon. One of Sir Geoffrey's favorite activities, at least with this would-be scholar collector, was to roam around the house and pluck Blake-related volumes off the shelves. He would ask me if I had the book. If I said yes, such as, I don't know what this is, but, oh, well, the Darwin, okay, accompanied by a sheepish grin of satisfaction, he would ask how much my copy cost and then tell me the pittance he paid for his usually superior copy. If he said no, or if I said no, I didn't have the book, which I didn't at the time, accompanied by a sigh, he would comment that I should try harder to find a copy if I expected to assemble even a modest Blake collection. Competitive habits were on display by both parties in this thoroughly enjoyable game. My infrequent triumphs, such as owning a book not at Lammas House, for example, Stewart and Revett, The Antiquities of Athens, with four engravings by Blake, were tempered by my host telling me that the only reason he didn't have such large folios because they took up too much room. Geoffrey Keynes was resolutely not an otherworldly, mystically minded, or poetical person. Why was he so interested in Blake? Keynes was a professional surgeon and amateur woodcarver. Both activities required a seamless intercourse between mind, eye, and hand as they engaged with recalcitrant materials. I suspect that Sir Geoffrey found similar fruitful alliances between desire and work, between eye and hand, in their struggles with the natural world as a theme in Blake's poetry and as a key component in his creative processes as artist, engraver, and printer. When Keynes was most active, he could acquire some of Blake's finest prints and drawings at modest prices. The situation was very different for Bentley. Now, I know it looks as though Jerry is proposing to Beth on bended knee, but actually they're sharing, looking at some print. I can't tell what it is, but they're studying Blake together, as always. Dealers had become all too aware of the value of even single pages from the illuminated books. Blake's commercial book illustrations, however, were still underappreciated and undercollected. When he began his searches for these volumes in the 1950s, I suspect that Bentley discovered what I found still to be true in the 1970s. Book dealers would have volumes on their shelves without knowing that they contained plates engraved by Blake. Shipping charges from Britain to America would sometimes cost more than the books. Bentley was able to build a superb collection of Blake's commercial engravings, including even such rare and important works as designs to a series of ballads written by William Haley, 1802. A true bibliographer, Bentley could not resist acquiring multiple copies for comparison. On several occasions in England and Los Angeles, I accompanied Bentley and his wife Elizabeth on book hunting expeditions. Jerry would roam the shelves, taking mental notes about likely prey. He rarely ventured to ask the dealer, "Do you have any Blake?" No need to clue him in. Beth and Jerry would then consult, sometimes even leaving the shop to ensure privacy. Beth would then return to open negotiations. Few dealers could resist her mixture of charm and hard bargaining. It was a perfect team effort. Collecting Blake and understanding Blake go hand in hand. The scholar must attend to the object, whether a scribbled document or a finished work of art, preserved by the collector, first as an object, then as the record of its production in time, then as a product of its multiple technological, biographical, and social context. We can then return to the object with a richer understanding of its meaning and significance. With Blake, the visual and the literary, the calcographic, the bibliographic, and the textual meet and mingle inseparably. Thank you.